So we're gonna go as we discuss the sort of identifying biggest questions in this broad spectrum that sort of on that hand is you know, nitty gritty details of cluster physics that I'm not clear how they relate to cosmology. And on this at this hand, people who don't care about the cluster physics or who don't want to care about cluster physics. And,
I'm glad you put them to the right. Thank you.
For him, it's the left he's looking at.
And I'm here the happy people who can talk to both or interested in both, so they because they have a chance to enjoy
conference pictures.
Huh?
Is that how you take a conference picture?
Actually, that's not a bad idea. Put people from left to right in there. Based on their yeah, so we already got quite a few ideas. So I remember the one that Josh brought up, which is that we should think about multivalence skin relations. I don't know how you want to phrase it.
I think that's probably as good as we can do for now.
I think scaling relations are definitely something in between because you know, they could be classified as astrophysics. Because they're interesting on their own from an astrophysical standpoint. They're definitely one of the most relevant things for cosmology. I can tell you for the conference, you know, you can guess which topic got the most applications for talks, scaling relations. So that's no surprise. So, scaling relations.
Andre, it may just be good for the non-experts in the room to just remind everyone what we mean by that. Or
well, actually, so the next thing is actually, I think it's not just a question of scaling relations. I think what we should think about, what is the, as we discussed, what is the general frame, how we should think about that. What is the definition and what is the proper parameterization? What is the proper mathematics actually when you talk about it? And I think the most general is PDF, right? So PDF is essentially what we're interested in is
probability. The stochastic function is what it's called.
The P and something.
P or, well, M, right?
Yeah, probably the M.
As a function of observables, and observables is a vector.
I like it.
They're related by
exactly.
You can write them either way.
Well, okay.
Write the inverse just to make everybody happy.
Yeah. why don't I do this?
Lately, the mass.
So for the complete non-experts, he's talking about mass proxies.
Oh, that brings up questions, great questions. So we'll probably talk about what mass
is. Andre, the other thing is you don't actually have to write it as conditional. You can write it as the full joint probability of mass and.
Do you want to write it out?
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that we
maybe easier for you to write. Well, but then just a joint. I mean that
if you put a comma there,
then
that's the most general thing that we can talk about, and then we can break it down from there.
Everything else that we've gone before is now in that function.
So for
so that folds into mass function. Right? Yeah. That's the only thing that makes.
I'm not sure like plasma conduction is in that.
You can point out
well, what mass to the degree that affects the others.
What mass do you mean?
But that also includes
the
redshift.
Right. So, yeah. So I guess that's a related question. Is that what is or cluster mass, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What do we mean by that?
Right.
I don't think we have to necessarily. I don't think we should necessarily talk about these things. We can. I mean, there's no problem. But we can actually spend the entire hour and a half talking about just those two things probably. Maybe we can just identify the questions and then actually think about them and have independent discussions and then come back in separate, focusing on all those things separately at different parts or different times in the workshop. And if you are here and you really want you want to be in a discussion session on a particular topic when you're here, it's a great motivation to volunteer in that one.
Andre, one thing, like, start with, and now we picked this question, maybe we can create some headings under astrophysics and cosmology separately that feed into that. So what are the astrophysical things that modify the scaling relations that we need to understand to get the scaling relations? Maybe that's just a way to start doing this, is to then tree out something.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, but I don't think we should leave that. Astrophysics is whatever people are interested in. Astrophysics of clusters, whatever we think is a big question, open question that cluster research that's related, not object related, but something that affects the cluster relation is.
Yeah, I mean, we can do it either way. We can do that first, and then we can start drawing lines between.
I think we can do it in any order we want, right?
Another suggestion for the middle column, that's the variant accounting problem.
Yeah, I actually was going to bring up.
I thought of mine.
I didn't want to bring it up because I was pretty sure somebody else would. But if not, I had it in the back of my mind. So, variant contact. And that's definitely in between because it's astrophysics, defined by astrophysics, but it's very relevant for speed states, for state care relations, and actually independent use of variant fractions for cosmology. In my mind, what fits into there is actually just as many things in cluster scaling relations is what puzzles me is not necessarily the measured baryonic content that seems to be like 2-3 sigma, maybe 3 sigma lower than it should be, or would we expect it to be. But that at the same time, so that by itself would suggest that there's some sort of feedback, some astrophysics going on. Which is fine, right? We see AGMs and so on. But what puzzles me in that conjunction is how so similar clusters are and outside the core. And that sort of, I don't know how to understand the low body of content and so similarity of SEM at R500 at the same time. So if it's AGM feedback, it has to be like almost so similar. It has to be feedback that's proportional to mass, essentially.
And that's dependent partitioning between the gas and the stellar population as well.
Right. Yeah. So they adapt to something constant, but not at the level that you expect. That's kind of funny as well, right?
That sounds like a good question to write down on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
Right? So I mean, you could just write these questions, right? Which is, you know, how do clusters lose half their mass but yet still look self-similar?
It's not quite half, I guess.
Well,
it's like 20-30%.
I mean, one way to do this is to ask, have everybody just say what question would they love to have answered in the next 3 months. Just write them all out. In the end, you can say how you did, and then you can let us know.
I won't define what core is. Yeah, I won't go into. Of course, but core means different things for different people. But I think if you go far enough away from the central galaxy, the peak of X-ray emission, definitely halfway to the visual radius that's outside the core. And this fits just in here, instead here. And this question, of course, I mean, it's sort of coincident that they're so similar. It helps a lot.
We probably also would need to define cluster because there's mass range. You wouldn't expect this go down to infinity. It's decreasing mass.
And again, for non-expert, self-similar here means that clusters are scaled down versions of each other just with one parameter, one scaling parameter would be mass or radius. And so they essentially, when we talk about self-similar, you can all thermodynamics properties of gas or stellar quantum could be, or not stellar quantum, it's not totally true. But thermodynamic properties of cluster could be just scaled down with one parameter. That was what similarity means. And if you look at SEM outside the core, it looks like it actually works pretty well, just scaling with one parameter.
So I was thinking, you know, why don't we sort of do what Lars suggested and everybody have their favorite thing?
Oh, just go and
just go around. So it's just for audience participation.
Well, my favorite thing is already here. So,
so we could each, you know, could each write sort of each one in.
Guess I already said mine.
Well, One of the things, in 3 months, it's a lot to ask, but I actually would like to see a framework in place that enable, that is an enabling framework going forward. That is to say, I would like to see people publishing data in a way that is somewhat standardized and in a way that is open to the ability for even theorists to go grab it. To some extent, now that's hard sometimes, but then
sociological request.
Sociological database. It's for the theorists / simulators in the room to, you know, we've been on the threshold, I think, of being able to make progress of publishing our work in a way that other people reuse and can use the data that we generate. Because we've got all this time invested in big supercomputers, we run these simulations, grad student creams the cream off the top, and then the data just sit around and die on disk. And that's sad, and that's embarrassing. And can we do better?
You're thinking about virtual observability.
Yeah, thinking about a data model for simulations, hooking that data model into the fledgling data model of observations. Can we develop a data model for cluster observations and a data model for simulations and in a way that they can interoperate? And a set of services, right? A set of web-enabled services.
So, Chris, how do you envision the data? You have a set of data that come out of the simulations, and you have a set of data that come observationally.
Right.
Where do you see them connecting? So there's one model for doing that, which is taking the simulated data and making it look just like the observational, mm-hmm. doing projections, doing these things, doing modeling. And the other way is to think about connecting them in sort of a physical space where the clusters that have, you know, you've identified a mass observationally and you connect them. How do you see that pulling together?
I think you identified the two ways that they fit together. I mean, the thing about, when you think about virtual observatory, and I don't know how many people you cringe in the room when you hear that term. Has there been much activity in here for any VO type people coming through, Bob Hanish or anybody like that coming through to kind of proselytize?
We get lots of people who want to proselytize.
Basically avoid it. Short answer.
Okay,
so it's about science. So if there's a scientific result, we're very interested.
But this is about enabling science, right?
I understand.
Yeah. So, you know, but so the answer would be, you know, everything on the right-hand side of the diagram, or everything on the left-hand side of the diagram, if you could put the data, if you could bring the data to bear on an appropriate way. But I think that the thing about, when you think about virtual observatory and observers, right, they said, well, what can we agree upon? Well, we can agree upon, right, ascension, declination, and wavelength. You know, and that's the starting point, is where on the sky and at what wavelength did you observe? And that's kind of a way to start. When you think about simulations, we don't have a right ascension, we don't have a unique coordinate frame to work in other than, you know, you can build a virtual sky and you can put up, you can expose your data through that method. Or you could think about the Halo framework and say, I'm going to publish Halo libraries, Halo catalogs. And there would be a different cosmologies of different.
So I would suggest you start a working group, and you could post meeting times on the wiki, and then create disciples that way.
Okay,
I think that's a great idea, because I think what's missing in this, there's been lots of attempts at doing virtual observatories from the simulation side, and I think what's missing, at least from my point of view, is that there hasn't been an agreement on what and observers need from the simulators and vice versa, right? Like, how do we connect in that, in the virtual space, so that we get what we need simply in the most kind of straightforward way? And so maybe that's something that we can spend time talking about over here.
It's hard.
It's not
going to
be easy. There's no
simple answer. Okay, fascinating. But maybe we should keep it moving, and then we'll come back.
The question that was brought up during coffee discussion, correspondence between K-words simulations and observable cluster, that's a big question, because any comparison between theoretical predictions and data will involve that to some extent. I think that question is sometimes is sort of implicit in analysis, but not very well spelled out. It becomes more and more important because we're pushing things towards more and more precision, and that definition becomes sort of crucial. What you call, for example, let me give you an example. So far, all the cluster abundances were calibrated using embodied simulations. I mean, pretty much any calibration was done using embodied. but at some level, maybe at a few percent level, some of these diaphragmatic cables may not have their gas because they passed already through cluster and gas got stripped. And so, you know, at some point we'll push a limit where something that you can identify in diaphragmatic distribution does not have observable counterparts because the gas is gone. And we know this happens, right? When you see a bullet cluster and gas is already displaced, maybe some systems already gas sort of dissolved and it's not very easily observable. And I think we will be hitting that at some point, so we'll have to start thinking about it. And it also, I think, relates to this more specific question about how do you define systems, because, you know, for observers, you know, okay, you can define your cluster in observable space in the way you want, but at some point you want to also relate to theoretical cluster, what people call cluster catalog from simulation. So correspondence between chaos and...
So correspondence, you mean basically defining the same quantity, or the establishing the method, or the methodology?
Well, so for example, a question, would each halo that you identify in a simulation be identifiable as a cluster using whatever cluster catalog you're thinking? I mean, it has to be specific to a particular cluster identification, right? Because what something can be, things that can be identified as X-rays wouldn't be the same as an optical.
Yeah,
I would slide that over to the cosmology side. It's really an accounting problem, and it's a unitarity issue at some level.
It's correspondent between
all two way
like non-fire.
We will run out of space.
You can connect the selection too, which.
Selection and cluster halo correspondence. Observe.
Yeah. Okay, Adam.
I guess I'm the first one on the board already.
It's gonna be your favorite.
Yeah. I'll just reiterate what we said in the earlier meeting, which is that having some sensible, well-motivated understanding of what the form of the scatter and scaling relation should be is kind of a crucial step in years anyway.
To some extent, it's true. If you understand this order well, then you essentially done the selection, right? Because you know how you're cutting on observables, right? You know how your selection cuts through the PDF. So selection is sort of part of that. So I think it's connects to.
So you can multiply that P there by another P of O, for example.
P of O. Yeah.
Yeah, the main one.
I think that template was correct in the most general way, and then, from there you can. Yeah, I think this question.
No, I think it's too general. For example, in SD service, the total SD signal from cluster should be, sensitive to the details of astrophysics. Okay, but for example, I would think a relation between the SD significance and the total SD, integrated SD signal to the cluster. This is something that should be more easily calibratable by simulations. For example, the relation between total SD flux and SD significance is something related to the overall cluster shape. Okay? And this is something that should be more robustly reproducible by simulations.
But the significance is going to be hard, right? Because then you really have to understand the details of the observations as well.
Right. So the relation between total SD flux and SD significance, that's what determines your cluster selection in SD surveys.
Oh, you mean that?
You don't want to fold SD significance into this probability distribution.
Okay.
I think if you do it, it will be too general and it will be too difficult.
I think so. So that means that what you talk about actually fits into multivariate cluster selection, right?
Selection should be separate.
Right. Right. It's a big topic. Yeah. But the arrow is actually means that it's connected. but yeah, it should be separate.
The problem with the P of M comma O is, as was pointed out, it encompasses, depending how you read it, almost everything.
Well, we're going to start
the podcast. Yes.
not to be interpreted as a mathematical expression precisely.
Just like occupies, not surprisingly, occupies the central part, and then, you know, it encapsulates a lot of things. Actually, you know, as you suggested, I mean, this could be a separate discussion, just that one part, that could probably be quite extensive.
Yeah.
That we can come back to. There should be a discussion group just for that part.
If I can put some on the very cosmological side, I think it'll be some of the astrophysics people. For example, question, for cosmology, do you really need to call something a cluster? There's other ways to frame the analysis that you never go in quantum, especially for optical or for SE, where you have full sky maps or where you can phrase it very differently.
Gus and I had a discussion about this, well, and I still don't understand the problem with the word cluster myself, but I've not run into the issues that you have before.
I phrase it, do we need to define cluster for the cosmology? I'm with you, I'm not sure. In fact, I think we may reach a limit where it's so difficult to figure out this part, like how you connect cluster, observable cluster to halos, that we have to think about this much.
So what you're saying is we're just talking about distributions of observational signal.
Yeah.
Power spectrum.
Yeah.
And something that requires definition. Like it's like there's something like this in halo definition, because halo definition is sort of also there is a discussion about how should we define a halo, and part of the reason is because there's a continuous underlying density field, so any definition is sort of arbitrary. There's some physics behind it, but it's kind of arbitrary always. And so in principle, you know, you could just talk about statistics and density. And we know from halo model, for example, that most of the information is just in power spectrum, right? For higher order iterations. But there are limitations to that as well. It's nice to think, we like to think about objects, I mean, somehow, conceptually.
I would like to make a plug for astrophysics. So let's have three astrophysics items. Yes.
I think one of the key things, and what I've been interested in is, and it's a big, one of the big questions, is this, the cycle of feedback and cluster. What is the cycle of feedback and how does it? So there's learning and there's feeding, and it's really unclear at this stage, I think, how that all fits together. And you know, all you see, we're looking at all the snapshots, but what you really don't have a good picture of is what's the cycle and how does that work. And I think that's really important to all the things we're going to be talking about.
Okay, so
do we dare put
AGN, supernova,
yeah, we everything, do. Everything, yeah. Anything coming out of the galaxies. And
I think supernova and blimps are the same.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. It could be.
Especially because you got supernovae going off in the ICO.
Yeah.
You so in this case, they're definitely not the same.
Well, what related to that, you can then also put up metal enrichment history, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not only contributing to feedback, it could be.
Yeah, also related but slightly worse thing is when and how is star formation shut off in satellites?
So, star formation in clusters.
What generally even not?
Interaction between galaxies and
star formation density relations.
So, yeah, so things like Rand pressure strip theory.
Yeah. Which, if you ever want to use richness, is a.
But these are just, I think Andre is exactly right to draw an arrow to, you know, what are the things that break cell similarity? What are the things that are non-gravitational that go on that affect the ICM and all of these things?
And of course, there is an arrow here as well.
Creating a three-dimensional.
Well, yeah, so when I thought about this, I thought it would be nice to have like a topological, you know, three-dimensional. Or at least, you know, like things with like links in between them. Because, but I know from experience that those things can become really complicated for us.
And so I'm going to put down my favorite diffuse transport processes. So conduction,
viscosity.
Now,
is that a question?
We'd like to know what they are, right?
How they work. Put your list of what those actually are there, yeah.
Well, so
I guess I let me add a more specific question to that. I mean, they're interesting in and of themselves.
Yeah.
So are they essential to understanding the global properties of clusters?
So
that's a question.
You know, so they affect cluster profiles, presumably. But is it good enough just to measure them and not care about how the cluster profiles came about?
Well, the non-thermal pressure definitely matters about it. It's all color spectrum and all these kind of masses.
So, I think maybe a more general one, just not thermal content of clusters. So thermal is magnetic fields,
cosmic rays.
All that feeds into the
development.
I guess 100%. I want to put up a warning. I think we're getting away from asking questions and listing topics now.
I think the topics are fine as well.
Okay.
Big topics that I think would be good topics for discussion here. I think we want to identify big questions and topics.
And I guess people will.
I don't think maybe sometimes definition is, you know, difference is not that obvious. But maybe what Mark is saying is that maybe useful to phrase not as a topic, but as a particular question.
So,
you know, not transport coefficient, just like
okay.
General, right?
But so, what are they?
I guess the reason I'm picking on this is sometimes people who are interested in a topic can drill down to lots of details and find them fascinating.
Right.
But the rest of us will say, why are we even interested in this?
Yeah, so it's a good way to approach it.
So, okay, so I would say that this you care about because of feedback, right?
Yeah.
So
I'm horrible. Look into this.
No, that's not just
so
that's not full. No, but that's only one part of it.
Yeah.
Why, how does it work?
It's getting too common.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, the physical mechanism is interesting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, well, yeah, that's
maybe composites work.
Role and
so maybe it's role and cycle of feedback. Right?
Yeah.
Defining the
cycle.
Mechanism to
define
feedback cycle.
I don't think we need to do this. I don't know, but I mean, we can elaborate later what I mean by feedback. I think people understand what feedback is, right? It's just some energy feedback from small scales to large scale, right? Whatever it is.
So what are the big questions here? I mean,
how does it work?
How does it impact as well as a question?
I think it's the role, right?
I can do the role.
Can you phrase the role as an impact?
Okay.
And it should be probably reversed because how does it work sort of has to be perceived
for the parents' role.
It's also, I mean, one big question with the how does the non-thermal content affect your mass observable and scatter thereabout? And can we do anything other than just parameterize it?
And for that matter, how does turbulence and non-thermal or non-thermal processes affect your metal distribution and how you enrich the gas?
How are we worried? It's a very interesting topic, metal enrichment. But how are we worried about it impacting the cosmology, or it at the crossroads?
I think it was a little off.
I think also one of the lingering, I still find it insufficiently answered questions about the metals is how it matches up with the actual stellar population, as indicative of a population of stars we're not seeing.
Okay, so
I think the metal enrichment, if you want to get into metal enrichment, if we can measure
missing stars,
whatever, it can inform these other things.
Information history.
I think the stellar content in clusters means more emphasis.
Stellar content.
In, just in general, I mean, in groups, the star conversion efficiency is higher than, you know, than what people think it is for Milky Way. You know, you convert 30% or half of the baryons into stars. It's just major source of whatever is going on.
And I think people would think about the stellar content from two communities from two directions, like clusters and galaxies. And there's a couple of attempts to sort of interconnect them, but I think it's still not. That's the area actually which could be nice to explore here. How stellar content constrained for galaxies. So what is waves, which was a very active field in the recent years, connects to stellar content of cluster that's directly calibrated system by system, essentially.
that sort of relative scaling relation, we just put a mass, it's halo dependent, stellar fraction and a gas fraction with a protobaryon fraction. It's just, and also the scatter.
So, do you want, so stellar quantum, I guess this is galaxy region, the stellar quantum probably should be along with baryon quantum.
Well, it's a subset of it for sure. But I think we're not interested in counting them.
We can also just put an arrow from baryon quantum over to
It's important for group and a lower mass halo, I mean, because that's the peak of the stellar.
Yeah, I would like to explore a connection between stellar quantum and the big clusters with the high redshift galaxy formation. Because if you believe that, you know, a substantial fraction of quarks that higher redshifts, then something like progenitor distributions for the clusters will play a major role.
I'd certainly be happy
with
that. One thing, kind of shifting topic a little bit, that I'll add towards the middle again, that I'm sure many people in here have thought about, and going back to the scaling relations and such, is how well do we have to actually do for the questions we want to address, whether it's non-Gaussianity or W, or getting the cluster mass scaling to address some of the other issues. So I think it's worth having a general discussion about how good is good enough.
So you want to know about this, how tight we have to get this, is it?
Yeah.
Let's go first. I have a proxy question from Megan Donahue, and it's astro-sociological, which is, how do we convince the broader community to invest in cluster cosmology, because it doesn't have a stellar reputation as some other?
So, why clusters?
Well,
what does it do better than
quantum mechanics?
So what do we do? What do clusters do better than other cosmological groups?
And I think the question is more, how do we convince people outside the cluster community that it's reliable or on par with other cosmological tracers inside?
Well, we first have to be sure ourselves.
And. Surprised nobody has mentioned KuKul in astrophysics. Well, sort of related, but I'm not going to raise question from observational side, just on the KuKul distribution with the halo mass and also with redshift. Just how the KuKul behave. Yeah. For example, if you go down with the halo mass, I mean, if you really go to the galaxy, really to the, it's probably all outflow, so there's probably no bimodality, whatever. So. Question is, could a bimodality could only exist for the cluster and it began to disappear from group?
So how would you phrase it as a question?
I would like to know, the question I would like to know the answer to is, are KuKul's intermittent phenomena? Or are you destined to be KuKul or non-KuKul kind of from the beginning?
Related to age or the cycle.
Is it part of the feedback cycle or not?
But I think it means the point is, these observation questions exist apart from understanding the feedback cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And they're important to know. Because they also enter into selection.
That's right, the luminosities contribute to a lot to the X-ray luminosity. Not much to the AC, but you use the X-ray luminosity to the cosmology. That's also sort of related.
I think it's more important to the SZ than you imagine, given the way the SZ clusters are selected presently.
So, something like that, you'd like to know where the bimodality comes from. And
why are you saying that?
Why?
Why are you saying
why,
that?
We should have experts from SPT and ACT come and speak about this, but currently.
Yeah, this is true only for interferometric part. If you do like Planck is doing, you don't really, I mean, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, to just be specific, if you have a look at the ACT catalog and how the clusters are identified so far, they're identified from a very small region that's inside the cool core.
Yeah.
Okay. And this you do then need to understand.
This is true for an interferometric experiment, as an envelope experiment. If you have a single dish experiment, this is not.
ACT is the same
thing
as SPT.
It's just different
bean
size,
I mean, we tested this one with Planck, and apparently it was not as
Planck is much bigger, right? Huh? I mean, the beam is much bigger.
Yeah, plus it's more massive clusters, which are maybe not as effective. But
right.
Clearly, this will be an interesting discussion. Yeah. No, cool quarter, I think, is a big, really big. So now we are aligned with cosmology, so.
Well, we put everything into, you know, this first level.
So I'll phrase, there's one question that I think we need to understand. I mean, there's a big one, how to constrain non-Gaussian diffusion. Clustering is a very active area that will be featured at the conference as well. But I think it's a good discussion topic as well.
We could put down how things like constraining, so that one is constraining inflation or constraining gravity.
Yeah, and also actually this could be one of them. We don't yet know what's where cluster. I mean, history shows that clusters are always underappreciated, but they always like contribute crucial information about cosmology before this theory.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go back and have low omega, you know, sigma 8, low sigma 8, lambda was also actually traced. So, it's just that people can't find it fully believable, but if you look back, all this information was very, like some of the early indications came from clusters always. That matter, right? Starting in the series. Talk about underappreciated.
I think Megan's question is really interesting sociologically.
Yeah. So for example, so such emergent things like constraints on Gaussian may well be the ultimate answer in the end. Who knows? Maybe clusters will emerge as the best constraint on Gaussian. We don't know this yet, right? Because a lot of surveys actually start to pick up large numbers of clusters at region B1, and that's very sensitive. I mean, once you get clustering is sensitive to Gaussian, it will also.
But Steve and Megan's point is still well taken, right? That clusters have done a pretty good job of getting at cosmology already, but it seems to have more of a perception issue than an actual issue, right? And you often hear people saying, well, that's under the work or all these kinds of things. And maybe people here have, but certainly I've heard proposals that have come back and said, we don't really believe this is going to work, even though it's in the literature, right? And so, I think it's just a question to think about.
But not Gaussianity is something you could have immediate success, right?
Yeah.
If you find
right. Because
it's
happening.
Yeah,
I think
see
it's
it.
Happening right now. So
as someone who cares deeply about how stars explode, but I don't care whatsoever how they're used for cosmology, it's very interesting for me to hear this discussion because don't forget, right, that we don't understand type 1a supernovae at all.
Yeah.
We understand clusters much better than type 1a supernovae.
Right. But this is
despite that, they are used for cosmology, and they continue to be used for cosmology. So if you ask why is that true, it's because the empirical, you know, they don't need theory for that exercise. It's pure empiricism, right? And so the question, so that question is simply that they've developed observationally independent information about empirical correlations that are not understood and are being used.
That's the same problem, right? It's redshift evolution. So you calibrate at low redshift.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So my question. So that's worst case in Europe. But they have a higher value. By the cosmological community, they place higher value on those the clusters. I think. I'm not saying it's correct, but I think that's the impression. So what do they have that you don't?
So for me, illuminating a part things in perspective to me were his papers by John Bacolo like 10 years ago. He has a number of them on SRPH about history of neutrinos, solar neutrino problem. And you know, if you look at those, he consistently like sounds very, very frustrated and annoyed how he spent 30 years trying to convince physicists that solar neutrino was a problem. And I think the problem they faced was is very similar to what clusters face, because there the problem was arising because of it needed to be compared to Siri. And you know, theoretical predictions were dependent on large powers of temperature and so on. And so physicists would just discard it. No matter what you tell them, you know, they bend the standards, but you know, we models are getting better. And sociologically they would just not pay attention because well, this is stellar structure and dependencies are key to training power or something. And so I think maybe there is actually no way to fight it. You just have to do what you think is, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, and you indicate it. Yeah, that's so neutrinos were. And it may not help with funding, though.
Even faster than resources.
I think the supernovae.
But I mean,
to
some extent, show
that they came.
But it's very hard to fight
it. Splash in '98, and that's probably saw them through for a little while.
Oh, I think that's. Yeah. No, I agree. But I just there's a question of empiric, you know, what you know empirically, independent. of any theoretical content will be used for cosmology, whether you like it or not.
Well, I think now it's been moved to a lot of actually all, I think most, maybe not correct, but a lot of cosmological constraints that come from clusters now rely not on theoretical predictions for, say, scale relations, but on empirical calibration for observations and cosmology, independent.
Yeah.
And so they're moving to that area, and those constraints become better and better.
Right, but what we have that Supernova doesn't have is the ability to now, right now we're doing things empirically, but when we get the next batch of data from DDS and with SKT and Air Rosita, I think that's where simulations hopefully will be able to come in to add value in terms of how to connect those different wavelengths, for example, and potentially put some constraints on, say, the form of the evolution of the scatter and the scale relations and stuff, so that we aren't working completely empirically, because that is, it's a case where we really think we know a lot of, modulo these questions over here. The bulk of the ICM is kind of boring.
Well, another analogy to the solar neutrinos is, so the neutrino problem helped you solve or learn something about quantum mechanics and particle physics that was unknown, and galaxy clusters can allow you to learn something about plasma physics.
Yeah,
you're not allowed to,
I wanted to point out that this, I think for plasma physicists, they're not the laboratories are also limited, right? Because the solar system, like regions around the Earth, and maybe throughout the solar system that's probed by spacecraft, then there are supernova remnants, jets, of course, AGM jets, and then clusters. I think a lot of, now clusters have become, getting more and more shocks and information about shocks, plus radio, gamma ray, acceleration mechanism. So clusters may emerge as one of the major plasma laboratories. And it's fair to say that we still don't understand. It seems like clusters have a carrier transfer very small mean free paths, but nobody understands exactly what's happening, right? What's the topology of magnetic field is, what the turbulence is, and what are the, it's probably some plasma wave going back and forth all over the place. And all this is sort of hard plasma physics, but how to constrain it using clusters is a big general issue, I think. And it sort of encompasses, I think it's even more general, it encompasses all these questions, which are interesting on their own from plasma physics standpoint, which is a big field.
So how about the new observations of, say, radio halos, what LOFAR can tell us, potentially what, Fermi could tell us. So, what?
I can start up a discussion group if you want on all the time, so I can start up.
But what are the big questions that you would be excited about?
Well, where do cosmic rays come from in galaxies? Where do they end up in? What's their effect on galaxy clusters? That's absolutely a good question. How can you get such efficient acceleration of cosmic rays at really low background shocks? People, you tell them it's supernova crowd, they jump in your face, because that's what it's observed. How do you get magnetic fields the way they are? Where do they come from? What instabilities do they give rise to? All the earliest kind of these types of things.
About the stuff that Shekhochidin does,
Yes. So his game is how do magnetic fields jump up out of nowhere, nothing, right? What source of free energy do they tap in order to get the magnetic field uptake repetition? How do pressure anisotropies feed into magnetogenesis, things like this?
So these are anisotropic transport coefficients in a way.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that over time, which is very great. I think it's a relaxation process. And I think it works because I'm right here.
Yeah.
All
right.
In the scaling relations, one thing maybe to look at individual parts of it, is it better to have a joint probability of all the observables or to make a new observable that involves the multi wavelength? Or should the simulations check out what they're looking at instead of,
some observables, some weight has another trend, because the gas is the biggest time for this. It matters how you construct an observable, because information comes. combines way more together. The meanings will be less of a thing.
I think that comes into a general question that could come under a heading of modeling issues and philosophically how you should handle this, whether one should. Many people would think that you just never mess with the data. You have your observations, and you should always bring your model to those observations and do it in that way. And there are many complex issues to do with biases that we have to be very, very careful about now as we move forward with these large data sets, that we have as a community been very lax with in the past. And there are problems where, for example, particle physicists or nuclear physicists have run into these head on, had it very clearly demonstrated to them after the fact that these biases were affecting their results. And it changed the sociology of how they do the science. And we are in a situation where we are faced with, at first glance, exactly the same problems, and we need to decide whether we want to try to get ahead of the game, not make all the same mistakes, and therefore be able to extract our information reliably.
So the biases you have in mind are, could you give some examples?
The classic example for the nuclear physicists is observer bias. It's just called observer bias. You have an expectation for what the answer should be, and subconsciously you will find yourself going toward that answer with your results. For example, you'll check really hard if it doesn't match something, right, and you won't check other ones. And there are some techniques to get you away from this bias, some very simple, some actually a little more sophisticated in how you get away from it. But you absolutely have to remove that subconscious bias. Or in some cases, of course, there may be deliberate biases.
So we all analyze data until we get time to CDM, and then we stop.
It's actually a very complex problem.
Somebody is interested. I've read there's a New York article, I think, from December, which is sort of funny. At first, I was sort of very funny because they were trying to, like, it sounded like they're trying to put the entire science sort of into dull. It sounds like the scientific method work or something like that. But it turns out that once you start reading it, it's actually kind of scary because apparently there is like emerging lots of evidence that, especially in biology and like social sociological studies, people get high significance interesting results, and then it's not that they're not confirmed. And significance like slowly decreases over time until it becomes essentially insignificant. So as studies are repeated, but significance is a steady trend this time. So probably put some. It's on the wiki. It's kind of interesting.
It's quite a good article, and it talks about how maybe there's a problem with deciding what's statistically significant or not, which is a fundamental problem with how you quantify things in all these studies, our work. And
they also identify that there may be a publication bias, for example, that after some exciting hot result is announced, people are reluctant to publish something that doesn't confirm it. And then after a while, when they forget it's not hot anymore, it actually becomes hard to refute it. So it's it's a very subtle
thing. Astronomy too.
Yeah, that happens in astronomy too.
Well, it sounded like it actually, because they give examples in different fields of science, so it sounded like it's connected to psychology, so it should be applicable to any field.
So maybe here's a
bonus question on the board, actually.
Observer bias.
So
we're lying to
the
This
is perfectly objective.
You have an answer that you're shooting for here.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a question.
Everybody
has a different answer for the
astrophysicist. Observation.
There is one real reason for doing this, because we use a lot of the simulation to do some of the tests, and the thing I noticed many times is that when we use simulations and we compare with observations, we try to show all the matches, and so we put all the effort and our stress on the things that are very similar. Okay, and we tend to forget everything. It doesn't match at all. We say just okay. We did not add this, but we really minimized this problem. So one big question that can
it's sort of indicating all the stuff here is do the simulated cluster really look like the real one?
Yes.
When they don't match observations, is how you actually go about learning something.
Say again?
I mean, when they don't match is where you actually have to
I know,
learn
but
something. So, yeah.
I mean, ask people to do the simulation. Tend to stress most of the time what matches, and they tend to minimize what doesn't match. Okay, I know only one guy that already started the talk saying, okay, we don't understand many things. But apart from this simulator guy, everybody else, including the guys in the room, it's not an accuse.
There's even that phrase that I sort of sick of. Simulations are remarkably successful on its way. Remarkably successful, I found it's overused.
It's almost as annoying as the statement gas is of the largest gravitational direction in the
universe. Well, they are.
Somebody explain why.
So, this is kind of observational bias because, no, we found some match and we tend to really stress this part.
Yeah, so that, I think there's a related question as to Paula's cosmology question, so feel free to add things here too. I think there is not enough thought being put into what are the alternatives to Lambda CDM or CDM. And I don't mean necessarily, you know, there's all kind of ideas, maybe there's modified gravity or whatever, but I'm actually not interested in those because I think they are really artificial, or at least aren't as artificial as Lambda CDM or more. I'm talking about, say, for example, if we talk about Perkemanji, you know, some theoreticians have discussed the general models of Perkemanji, for example, with small sound speeds where Perkemanji starts to cluster. There's a paper by Kaminerito last year. That actually, that, for example, affects masses of clusters because now Perkemanji is quantum dynamics. And it's a nightmare for simulation because it's not clear to me at all how to simulate. Maybe it's not even easy. Well, it's probably possible, but you have to modify how simulation is done. You have to follow the field. And so far, I don't know if it's biased or not, but people just go, because when there's no particular theoretical preference for any of these models, people just assume that sound speed is large, that kind of doesn't cluster, and just go with it. And so a lot of simulations are called the Kennedy simulations. They're actually just a subclass of the Kennedy simulations. And we have to remember, because the effects on if sound speed is low, then effects on cluster masses are actually a few percent, and those are not negligible effects, and they can be masking as well. And a priori, we don't know what the effect energy is, so we don't know what the sound speed is.
But Andrew, why did you discard modified gravities? And like we heard,
I didn't discard them. I just said personally, I wouldn't be interested in talking. I think that before there was a history that there was simply no self-consistent theory. Now there is tethers, but it's actually has more. Fields than Lambda CDM. So by Occam's razor, I would discard it for now because, you know, unless we need more fields, I don't see why you have to introduce tensor fields and, you know, more than what we already fit the data, except with some theoretical loosey.
That's right. But that's that's different question from just testing Lambda CDM. And which way can you test it, whether it's right or not? I mean, you should still. We still have the ambition to do some testing or to question it. Featuring any alternatives or.
I agree. I think there is a criticism that occurred about the field is that there are not enough ideas or alternatives. I don't know why this is, but I think it may be because Lambda CDM is pretty good, so people are pretty happy with it until they'll be, you know, faced with an editor, unless it really runs into huge problems.
We have a lot of string theorists in Stanford, and I know there are a lot here as well, but yes. This was discussed at the dark energy workshop we had before, just before Christmas. And if you get those guys to come and speak about it, it seems they have a very strong opinion that nothing other than Lambda CDM makes any sense at all.
And really?
They feel that there is at least
10 years ago.
Hmm?
Or they didn't think so.
They didn't think so 10 years ago because they think they realized some important things to do with the. Essentially, it comes down to the degrees of really exaggerated fine tuning you need to have, and there's just one enormous 10 to the 120 something for Lambda CDM. There are at least two, but that signs for everything else. Maybe like the first one.
So we have the two to be, W to be close to minus one, but not exactly, is it? Is that the statement?
It's just they like the cosmic landscape vision, and there are a near infinity of lambda universes, and they'd rather buy that than the extraordinary fine-tuning of trying to take two pieces of 10 to the 120 something and put them together, which is the absolute value and the gradient. So, but that was the result of having experts.
Right, but this is string theories, which is, I think, is strongly like, because it's strong prior belief that they have widened the altogether. But I think a lot of people actually like Lamsdin because OGR in general, because it was remarkably successful. And I think recent attempts to modify GR, which are very quickly constrained but excluded by the data, demonstrate just how difficult it is actually to modify. So, you know, it's sort of amazing that Einstein got it so right and so this two decades of data. Whereas, you know, you put modifications like FNR, you know, it's pretty much constrained to be very little different from the LMCDM by now, right? Or DGP is excluded. There's more general class, you cannot keep adding parameters, but it just demonstrates, you know, you modify, you make simple reasonable modifications, and they quickly exclude by the data. Whereas GR is not so far. And I think for that reason, there is people sort of feel that, you know, all the problem that formation of clusters facing LMCDM is relatively tiny compared to the global problem that other models use.
Well, Andre, maybe the question that you're asking then is, are there constraints that clusters provide, that are clusters particularly sensitive to alternative cosmologies that typically aren't looked at? So are there, if small modifications are made that don't violate other things, does that show up in the clusters?
Yeah,
and if that were true, that would be very exciting. Right? So that maybe that's something to talk about.
Well, clusters probe growth, right? They only make new cleansing that over redshift space distortions or something. So that's the niche.
And non-Gaussian.
It's something like there's the research that Wayne Kuhl and other people are doing. There's an intermediate transition region between linear and non-linear, so it's outskirts of clusters and region around clusters that seem to be particularly sensitive to modification of gravity. And that's topic that's just started to be explored, essentially. So it may well turn out that clusters may be unique in some way. If you identify what it is that is sensitive.
Yeah, is it the matter distribution or the velocity field that you want to measure?
Yeah, so I don't know exactly what to say. So I think the point is that standard GR works so well on highly nonlinear regimes, any viable modification of gravity model has to have some sort of convenient mechanism that sort of goes into GR and highly nonlinear. And it's an intermediate regime where it goes from so modified gravity, which drives acceleration, to almost GR-like behavior is interesting. That's where you can pick up what it produces.
So I just wanted to go back to this point of observer bias. So has there been anything done where people say like Gus pulls up his virtual catalog and he has a whole bunch of clusters and some are not lambda CDM and different people analyze them? Do they all get the same answer?
So that exercise has not really been done, but the dark energy survey we have a plan for blind cosmology challenge to do exactly this exercise.
Okay.
So there will be over half a dozen skies built, and we'll hand them over to the science teams and then see what happens.
So on a related thing, it was brought up
simply blind
earlier, I think it would be useful to somebody's put underneath the virtual database thing is, you know, do simulated clusters match real ones, for pick your favorite definition of match. And what do we actually learn when they don't match?
So I think we know, I think there is like very nice developments in the last decade in that respect. I mean, it was clear to identify the cores don't match, and outside the core, a unit actually pretty good. It probably has no business of being so good, but it is. So that question has two answers: yes and no, depending on where you look, how close you're sending it.
But this is something that would be nice to have discussions about, which is, what do we feel as a group are the things either that we're getting close to understanding that aren't well done yet, things in the core, all those kinds of things, and also as a group, which things do we think we ought to be focused on that are the most important in the short term that we can drive on? Because there are things, the improvement in computational capabilities, kinds of things are allowing for more things to happen. And the question will be, how are we going to decide whether we're getting better and which things are we going to try to match exactly? That would be something worth
talking about. It's also worse to, like, when disagreement, we should consider everything, because if you look at profiles or scaling relations outside the core, say for gas, you can think, well, we can declare victory, things match. And then you look at variant content, it doesn't match. You look at stellar content, it doesn't match.
Yeah.
If disagree, I mean, there's a part of the agreement in one thing, which seems to be pretty good, but it's not like we can't be comfortable, we can't declare victory because.
By the way, it's not even complete, because it's just an intermediate range. Yeah. It's not outside, it's outside the core, and well within half a hundred or.
Right.
A little bit around after land, but I mean, you don't know what is going on.
Well, the observations, right, are still.
No.
But now, once you get observations further out, then you start to see that it's.
Well, and then it also is a global property, because, I mean, if you start to add some extra physics, you start to get all these small blobs. I mean, I've been in this business of comparing a simulation and observation, and I know what the observation looks like. And it's horrifying when you try to really look at the simulated data from an observational point of view, because sometimes the profile matches, but something else doesn't, even at larger radii.
But at larger radii, for example, this started to be comparison been done already, and it's interesting because I think what's emerging is that observations from Suzaku were indicating that things don't quite match, but it turns out the simulation actually can explain why it doesn't match, that they actually bias.
But your point is a good point, that they don't have any business being that good, considering that we're not getting everything right. And so if we're getting some things exactly right, but not others.
It's kind of puzzling.
That's
because the agreement is so good that it's like, well, maybe we'll get something right, but other things aren't just so much. So
that's worth talking about, is just, when can we declare victory? What are the things that we need to declare victory?
Well, I think that's something different when declared, or it doesn't have to be declared. When this workshop will draw like 10 people and they're all like 60 or something. That's victory. If you look around, it's pretty, this was heavily oversubscribed workshop and very close to young people, so I think there's no victory yet, because you don't want to some extent, you don't want to declare victory.
This is essentially a galaxy formation problem, right? So when are we going to declare victory over on galaxy formation?
I hope that clusters you can do
well, sooner. Let me turn that into a question, because sometimes when I look at this problem, I say it probably has aspects in common with galaxy formation, but we're lucky that we can observe what the variants are doing in these systems.
Yeah.
And hopefully what we learn from that can be applied to galaxy formation smaller scales.
Well, I was going to ask, how much do we care about groups? We always talk about clusters, but groups are like Santa Barbara. Clusters are Chicago. And probably in terms of cosmology, they're less important. But in terms of
the temperature.
But in terms of astrophysics,
because the
true. So everybody said yes. So why?
But do we have to differentiate groups and clients arbitrary, right?
I think it's under the maps definition. It's all.
Yeah, but it also has to do with self-similarity, the breaking. I think if we just decide that we go further down the mass function.
But some processes are different, right? Like this is not important anymore. And the baryon fractions are extremely different.
What did you say?
I'm not sure we can quite that say it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry?
That'd be important.
Well, that's a good question.
Maybe why is it different?
And right, that's a good question. When do the things that make clusters stop be important.
I think it's actually arbitrary definition always, and it's. I think it would be nice to actually think about mass spectrum as open-ended, because there is even more severe Biden problem galaxies, and maybe they're related. Maybe there is like systematic progression with mass, that in galaxies you have a severe problem and for clusters becomes better and better, because for clusters we see that Biden fraction, this whole gas fraction seems to increase with cluster mass, and there are papers now that seem to suggest that there is a continuous progression towards galaxies, so galaxy halo detection is very hard. But, you know, I would try to think about it as open-ended, because, you know, you can cut in mass, 10 to 16, 10 to 12, whatever.
It's very there's a group of thought now that 10 to 11 really is something because of this cool flows.
So we can agree that the low 10 to 11 don't take up to 12 clusters. Because, I mean, people can come up with multiple definitional clusters, but is it interesting? I mean, we know that there's underlying spectrum that's continuous, right? So why do we come to work?
But I mean, all I'm saying is that, you know, when you look at talks and conferences, most of them focus on big guys, right?
Yeah, sure.
Is that the right balance?
You can definitely extend the mass function, the halo mass function, but I think one thing is that probably the most interesting part of the mass function is not well explored. I mean, the mass, the halo that was mass lower than group but still higher than the galaxies, that's the part that maybe the star formation efficiency as Lexi mentioned, that's maybe the highest, and also the baryon loss into the large radii could be the most significant.
There are systematic, you know, trends. Why do we have to limit ourselves only to talking
about systems? From an observational point of view, maybe the most interesting group, we don't really have much leverage to start it. That's just below the current.
Right, it's just the group data is so, you know, there's just not much.
10 to the 13 solar mass, probably actually below 10 to the 13 is actually more interesting. It's just more difficult to observe. Just lose the leverage to really see those variables.
Yeah, maybe you can start declaring victory mass decay by mass decay.
I think even if you use the biggest clusters for cosmology, you cannot claim that you understand, you know, underlying astrophysics unless you demonstrate that you can explain the lower mass systems,
right,
those groups well.
Yeah.
So it could be thought of as testing ground for cosmology.
Yeah, this is something like you go down mass function, you have higher mass cosmology, then the really galaxies, astrophysics thing in the middle is something combined.
And then when you quote, you know, huge numbers of clusters from big surveys, by many people's definition, these huge numbers are actually, you know, groups. So,
right.
100,000 clusters on the sky is mostly, you know, low mass systems. So if you want to use those systems for cosmology, you have to understand groups.
It's just that, you know, saying this thing, people always try to fix the overcooling problem in clusters, but, you know, a lot of the fixes that you use may not work in groups, and I think groups are really important.
I think a related question, which comes back to the point Alexei was making, is it's complicated but very important for us to figure out exactly which clusters we want to use for the cosmological measurements themselves. Others we will get a lot of astrophysical information from as well. And it comes back to the point Gus made right at the start of the very likely increasing complexity of the scaling relations and additional degrees of freedom we will need to use to parameterize things. That brings a cost when you bring those in. And so there will be an optimal place.
Yeah, because you're increasing statistics, but increasing complexity. Yeah. Somewhere there's a sweet spot. Maybe it's a good question, Josh.
It's a trade-off point.
I think it is a very important thing for us to deal with. And if I could perhaps suggest something that relates to that as well, that maybe an interesting project for us to think about. Coming back again to Mark's question about why clusters have got kind of short deal from the community of perception. For what it's worth, Mike Turner gave a talk a few weeks ago where he was talking about dark energy, and he put up two figures, one of which was success to date for the different techniques, and another was prospects, potential for the future. And in success to date, for dark energy alone, supernovae were at the top. Clusters were second. And I forget, I think BAO and then weak lensing, so working down, okay? For potential for the future, weak lensing was at the top and clusters were at the bottom. Now, I think that's probably not correct. And there are huge systematics affecting weak lensing for sure. It's a very difficult thing to do. But maybe one of the things that we could do is come up from this group with what we think is a consensus view of how well galaxy clusters can do with forthcoming surveys, so that at least our view as a community is out there for people to compare with the other techniques that will be done, that will be weak lensing. Because I know Alexi and I were involved in an email exchange today when being asked, well, just how well do we think galaxy clusters will be able to do with forthcoming surveys? And I've got an educated guess of how well we do, but it's not as educated as I would like it to be. I could certainly.
But you guys thought about it for various proposals, right? For
yeah.
WFST.
We thought about it, but not as hard as we'd like to.
Consider it's pretty easy to get the number you want really for a proposal, right? You can make it. In the podcast business, honestly, you can.
But that's exactly not the point, right, Carlos?
Exactly.
We really want to be as honest as we can. Because this is not a marketing exercise so much anymore. Those decisions have been made. It's about trying to find our best guess at the truth.
But this connects to the question of the alternative models and under or down there. If you're just asking how well can we learn lambda from clusters, it's probably not super impressive compared to other techniques.
That's right.
But if you're interested in measuring the growth function without making assumptions about dark energy, that sort of thing, it's a very different answer.
It's very difficult. I know that, coming back to the physics, it may be a futile exercise to convince people's bias to believe, even though you're right. And maybe the way to go is not directly to say, well, loop clusters are just as competitive to those loop here, there's other techniques also have. Maybe easier and more productive to actually identify in which way clusters are complementary, in which ways they are unique, and which things they can just blow out of the water. Like, for example, for non-Gaussianity, it seems like clusters are emerging as unique probes, right? Beyond region one. Like, and nobody would probably even contest that. There'd be no discussion. And so maybe identifying those areas or in which ways clusters are complementary is also a good way.
It
becomes much easier to convince people psychologically. They say, oh, yeah, right.
But I think we need to do the other piece as well. I agree with what you're saying completely. It's very important to do that. But to really understand the potential power that we have in the vanilla forms of the questions as well as the more exotic ones is important, I think.
But sort of, I think the court sort of knows the answer. The answer will be completely in the scale of relations, right? We know how to predict the forecast from standard methods, from clustering and from abundance. And we'll all be limited by papers were written, how well do you need to know scaling relations to achieve statistical accuracy in future surveys, and the answer is 1 to 2%, and that's your answer.
But the answers depend very sensitively on the question you ask, and so I could reword what I just said in terms of what question should we be asking in order to get the predictions
to
answer.
So then we're converging sort of to the same point that how to present clusters in a way that they become sort of unique and this discussion becomes
I would even suggest, coming up with at least several strategies for doing, for providing, this kind of answer for several plausible strategies for doing cluster cosmology, because, you can quote one finger of merit for an optical survey, you can quote another finger of merit for, what could be done with XO, etc.
So this sort of relates, I wrote, how best to use clusters to constrain the grammar, much better than correct, but how best to use clusters to constrain the exclude models. But here, what are the strategies for cluster cosmology, the best strategies for using clusters for cosmology?
Do we have a complete spectrum of possibilities how to measure W with clusters, and what figures of merit for W and those.
Well, let me suggest other kind of figure of merit. Right. Clusters, part of the niche is they're measuring growth. And the figures of merit that are often talked about are dark energy type figures of merit, where they're trying to measure acceleration. And there is no common figure of merit I know out there that is just focused on growth.
There is the growth parameter.
Well, there's the growth parameter, but is that the right figure of merit? In other words, the cluster competitor here is going to be weak lensing, which is not yet competitive with clusters. And so if we're having the discussion, how do you measure growth? Cluster may seem more competitive if you talk about figures of merit that are related to measuring growth.
So the actual effect of this graph probably is also that what dark matter hasn't appeared on the blackboard. Dark matter profiles.
Lensing people, that's why.
One thing that, I think we are laying down the foundation, but sorry, you were insufficiently.
The idea is that this is a foundation that we keep building on. And at the end of the workshop, actually, would be good that there is a summary session, which also will be, so you guys will be able to check out even if you're not here. So how this evolved toward the end of the workshop. So we have to refine these things, right? Even I would say that it would be good to do what Steve suggested is to whoever feels most passionate about one of these things, organize a discussion group during the upcoming week, and come back to this refinement. We'll have these lunches regularly, and so maybe we'll come coming back to one of these issues and talking about that in more depth, in more detail. One thing that we sort of talked about as part of this, but I don't think they're spelled out, and I'm not sure if we want to spell them out unless they're obvious. What are the possible projects that you could come up with, or is it sort of outcomes of the workshop? I think one was that was discussed is a general framework for how to deal with scaling relations and selection.
Language.
Maybe too ambitious, I don't know.
Doing a real-time database for simulations.
Maybe you mean the format?
Talking about data models,
how we do it. How would you implement it? What's the best way?
What's possible projects?
I think there's also the question of federating the observational data sets in a more streamlined fashion. You think about going to HESARC for X-ray stuff. Right now, there's not that much in the submillimeter, but that'll come. And then, optical. It's kind of we have these resources. It's very hard to identify where you go to get the either the raw data or process results. There's box. There are a couple of attempts so far to federate things, but I don't know how well they're working or who's. Do we need four of them? Do we need one in Europe, one in America, one in Japan?
But this is denied because I think the observers are in better shape than the units in
providing
things of data and in a more standardized fashion on an online.
Yeah.
It's also in what format can each one be presented, expressed that's most transparent, useful for
I guess there's a huge data transfer management issue here, because I guess the simulations may be even bigger than the problems we're facing with LSST, but LSST is a vast amount of data, and just how do you how do you handle the data when you're not sure that you can process it in the way it needs to be processed first time around?
On the simulation side, right, they've done some of these things where, like, for instance, the GABA stuff, right, where they've created an interface such that you can do the processing on the back end and only bring the things that you need. And so there are sort of some ways to think about that, but it's definitely a problem, there's no question.
Yeah. So you get the questions around
the first one.
What are the
basis numbers? Yeah. Those are the kind of things I think would be good to talk about in terms of what data products are interesting, how do we manage that interface, that kind of thing.
For the cosmology part, another thing I was thinking, because we look like we concentrated just on cluster of galaxies. But the question is, how can we use whatever we have in a cluster of galaxies together with other observations to do cosmology? In particular, I have the one thing in mind, that is to measure W without putting the constraint that the universe is flat, okay, for example. So how cluster can help, and what should we do also in respect of future missions?
What are the drug events?
In particular, not removing some of the constraints. I mean, all the kind of measurements on W are made assuming, using cluster, for example. They all assume the universe is flat. Okay. But if you remove this constraint, then you don't constrain anything at all.
Unfortunately, the good news there, Pasquale, is I think Planck is good enough that so long as you have the processor power to handle doing it in the analysis that the most groups should, the answers don't change very much. The data are becoming so, they yeah, should be becoming
so.
Blind
wire, so it's
we,
blind
yeah.
Result.
Yeah.
Well, or maybe another way is to say that is, you know, we're not going to be writing papers where we don't bring in CMB and other information,
yeah, sure,
you know?
Sure.
So to just try to write a paper that uses only the cluster information is not going to be very interesting.
I think for some things, for people cluster data will not be competitive. I mean, curvature probably will be constrained much better than other things.
But the general point is a good one. Yeah.
But you have to consider not just flat assumptions, but prior to model.
Yeah.
Do you want to put in a plug for dot matter profiles?
As interesting, I think Bechner profiles is one which is very sort of messy subject because Bechner profiles I would put somewhere in between here actually because there's as much astrophysics.
Another thing we can add on there for completeness is just clusters as tools for studying very high redshift galaxies, pre-reionizations.
You mean the
That means you have to do the mass reconstruction really well a lot of times.
Depends.
But yeah, there are a bunch of notes doing
it. Depends on the data across the tier trying to reconstruct back in shape.
But constraints of back there also came from more spectacular from the board, right?
Sure.
That has nothing to do with profiles, it's just much more basic.
How about protoclusters? There's a lot of interest in that.
I
think that people are interested in this. I'm just saying this.
Redshift
as a separate book.
Okay.
It won't make it.
Information on the red sequences.
I think it's part of a general book cluster evolution.
But I think observationally it's interesting because people are.
So for cosmology, as we go beyond redshift 2, my understanding that it becomes essentially irrelevant for cosmology because any information beyond redshift 2 is already mostly encoded in CMB. So for cosmology, what matters is what happens in redshift. Well, for the longer oceanic, maybe it's actually any redshift is important. But for constraints on other cosmological parameters, what you actually want to know.
Yeah. You often want to move away from the CMB to get more leverage.
Yeah. But for, from Gauss formation standpoint, actually, it's whatever.
Okay. Well,
So we almost built the network, and I'm sure look at the.
It's funny that the projects that are listed there are all very theoretical. Yeah. What I anticipated was that people would start saying things about writing
concerning proposals.
Yes. I think it was phrased as projects to focus on during the next 3 months.
Yeah. Okay.
Do HST proposals to focus on in the next 3 weeks.
Yeah. but it is true that there is a lot of expertise here, and there's a lot of randomness in how we could select or who could come at what time, but there is some attempt to also bring people who have complementary expertise together. So it's nice. I think it's a great place to take advantage of that.
For example, in what is it called? The Chandra Extremely Large Project?
Visionary.
Right. I mean, how many cluster proposals are going to be in that panel? You know, several? Why, maybe we put this, then you could pre-select down. self-annealing, you know, self-joining in a way that is, the sum is better than the, bigger than the.
No, I think
that's fire too, though.
Well, I'm not trying to force marriages here, all right? I'm not putting a shotgun in anybody's head, but it's just.
So why did you mark it down?
But the general point, I think, is good, right?
I think part of the selling, if we want to talk about sociology and why clusters reliability issue, is that we're a big community, and we always have been. And so you get different perspectives from different people. You know, well, so the sort of friendly competition that happens within the community can be viewed from the outside as uncertainty about what's actually going on, in the sense that if we are kind of slinging mud around a little bit internally, we understand how to rationalize that, but from the outside, you know, it doesn't present a unified front. You know, that's not to say that because we're a big community, it'll never be just one, we'll never be able to congeal into one fighting unit collectively. But I think evolutionarily speaking, we probably want to head this way if we want to address the question of why clusters and demonstrate that we can speak with one voice.
There's an example from quantum,
Lattice QCD,
where community, I think they probably were forced by pressures to do that, but the entire community, which is actually very big, presents itself to all the funding agencies as just one body. And they get global funding for the field, and then inside they sort of.
Now there's the problem.
Somehow manage. Apparently, the claim is that it works.
That's just the unified front.
So inside is a federation. That's how it's going to be. But when it comes to funding, they actually congeal and sort of come as a single force.
Actually, you know, what you're saying for the visionary program is not that wrong, in the sense that the proposal of the visionary program will be judged not just by cluster people, but it will be all the community that will judge which one is going to pass or not. Mm-hmm. And having, like we already have, many proposals, submitting proposals in class, that doesn't look, may not look very nice. Or
well, I'll put another, I put a positive spin on it. I think a single proposal or a proposal that involved a large fraction of relevant players, and that demonstrated that had historically worked separately, but you know, I think that would be an interesting statement to.
I don't know, it's something that we should think about.
Well, did those white papers actually influence the decadal survey people, or? I mean, there were so many, yeah?
No, it's funny, decadal survey has many sort of funny aspects of the thing, but you see, I read some of the white papers, and I could see some of them being reflected in various parts in some way. What is not clear is how those, they were mentioned, and the science was mentioned, but then I found that there was quite a bit of disconnect between what it was called exciting science and what they actually showed in that submission. So, there was almost no correlation. But you could see that the white papers were read and inference somehow. So I think the pressures for actually rating were different from just what's on the consulting. I don't know what the ultimate use of white, like what the ultimately useful white papers are. I guess everybody decides to live on their own and you know, whether they write one or not. But
it's big and it's white.
but the response to the call to those white papers.
No, there were tons of white papers. I'm just, you know.
They were like a lot of them were really good.